streets where he was writing letters off a shingle on his knee. "How'd it go, youngster?" Jeff hung his head. Slumping to a seat on one of the lower bunks, he stared at the earthen floor, covered with yellow straw. "I feel low down as a snake," he said, and told Noah and the others all about it.
"Don't volunteer like that for extra duty," Noah warned, looking up soberly from his shingle. "Far as that's concerned, don't ever volunteer for nothing. I tried to warn you, but you moved too fast for me."
Miserable, Jeff kept shaking his head. "That cow was all the livestock they had," he said. "Now those children won't have any milk to drink." He was thinking of the tall, blue glass bottle of cold milk he had drained back in the McComas kitchen. John Chadwick whistled incredulously.
"You mean this is the same family that sent us the apples?"
Jeff nodded glumly. Bill Earl, squatted on his heels, shook his brown head in bafflement.
"War's hard," he said philosophically. "I wish they was something we could do about it. But they ain't nothing we can do, not a gall darn thing."
Jeff glared at him, an idea forming in his mind, a bold, crazy idea that didn't make sense at all. Maybe he couldn't do anything about it, but he could try. The McComases had fed him and given him apples for his comrades, despite the fact he was an enemy. And this was how they were repaid. Impatiently he crawled to his feet. It was still an hour before bedtime. He looked at Noah, sudden decision in his face.
"Who's the sentry down at the corral tonight?"
Noah peered up at Jeff.
"Oscar Earnshaw. Why?"
Jeff looked at Noah meaningfully, without replying. He knew he could trust Noah, and Bill and John, too, for that matter. He put on his coat. He felt lots better about it, now that he had made up his mind.
"Careful, youngster," Noah warned in a low voice as Jeff went out. "It's after retreat, you know."
Jeff found Oscar Earnshaw standing behind a tree in the corral, blowing on his hands. Oscar was a fleshy fellow, with long brown sideburns that came clear down to the lobes of his ears. He had leaned his musket against the corral fence. Oscar peered uncertainly at Jeff in the dark, reaching for his gun. Jeff hastened to identify himself.
"It's me, Jeff Bussey. I want to talk to you a minute."
Suspicious, Oscar kept his musket in the hollow of his arm and thrust his hands into the sleeves of his gray coat for warmth.
"What do you want to talk about? I was hoping you was coming to relieve me. It's cold out here as a well digger's bloomers."
"Oscar," whispered Jeff, "how'd you like those apples I brought you yesterday afternoon?"
Oscar looked sharply at Jeff.
"You didn't come way out here in the frost just to ask me that. You know how well I like them, best wine saps I ever et. Only thing, they wasn't enough of 'em, why?"
Jeff went straight to the point.
"Look, Oscar, if I bring you a big slice of home-baked light bread with apple butter smeared all over it, would you do something for me?"
Oscar took his hands out of his sleeves and thrust them under his armpits to warm them. He looked inscrutably at Jeff.
"Depends," he said. "You know, I'd do murder for a feast like that. But where are you going to get any light bread and apple butter around here, let alone at this time of night? This is the army camp. All we got to eat here is buckwheat and beans."
Jeff told him about the McComases.
"Oscar," he concluded boldly, "I want you to look the other way while I take that black and white heifer out of the corral and drive her back to the McComas farm."
Oscar's eyes twinkled shrewdly. He stared thoughtfully at Jeff.
"What do you mean, look the other way?"
"I'll help you cut her out myself. The corral's full of cows. They'll never miss one."
As Jeff moved off, driving the cow ahead of him, Oscar warned in low tones,
"Be sure to come back through my sentry position and bring the bread and jelly."
Jeff nodded, herding the cow off the road into the dark woods. The beast went willingly enough,
as though she knew the path. As he walked, Jeff could feel the damp cold shutting down on him. An hour later, he drove the animal quietly into the Macoma's corral and locked the gate. A big, smoky moon, yellow as brass, was rising through the branches of the apple trees. The house and the barn stood silent in its glow. Jeff took the milk bucket off the oaken peg, rinsed it at the well, and finished milking the heifer. Walking up to the back door with a half-filled bucket in his hand, he knocked and called out guardedly, "Mrs. McComas?" After he had called several times, he heard a noise inside and somebody stirring. Mrs. McComas opened the back door cautiously. She was holding a hog fat lamp in one hand. It splashed faint pools of light here and there in the yard. She looked frightened and sleepy. Jeff said, "It's me, ma'am. I brought your cow back. Sentry helped me smuggle her out of the corral. I just now finished milking her for you. Here's the milk." He thrust the bucket toward her. Puzzled, she set the lamp down on the table. Brushing the hair out of her eyes, she accepted the bucket with a look of astonishment. Quickly, Jeff told her about the confiscation detail and how they had all volunteered for it without knowing what it was. 10 minutes later, he was on his way back to camp, carrying a couple of fresh apple butter sandwiches in his blouse for Oscar Earnshaw and gorging another she had given him for himself. 3 months later, he wasn't so fortunate. On a balmy day in January, Captain Clardy ordered all guns cleaned for a noon inspection. Walking a short distance into the woods, Jeff raised the old-style musket to shoot it off, preparatory to cleaning the barrel. An unpleasant memory stayed him. Remembering his arrest and punishment for doing this same thing on the march to Springfield, he lowered the weapon. He decided it would be more discreet to go to Clardy and get his permission. Ushered by a sentry, he found Clardy inside his quarters in the officer's barracks. A fire burned cozily in his California-type furnace, a hole dug in the ground and covered with a removable stone. The smoke was tunneled to an outside flue. A long blue overcoat, a cape, and a pair of gray woolen drawers hung from pegs in the wall. Clardy's glistening black head was bent low over his reports. They were alone. The captain didn't look up. Jeff saluted briskly.
"Sir, may I have permission to fire off the load in my musket so I can clean it? It'll take too long to draw the load with a ball screw."
Clardy's probing eyes rose slowly and deliberately over the feathered end of the quill with which he was writing. He transfixed Jeff with a cold, naked stare, letting him stand for a whole minute with his question unanswered. Finally, the captain seemed to tire of this sport. He dropped his gaze back upon his reports. He nodded curtly. "Permission granted."
"Thank you, sir."
Feeling relieved, Jeff backed out. He walked 200 yards into the woods, fired into a sandbank, and had hardly begun to clean the barrel when a patrol swooped down upon him, arresting him by the order of the colonel. Jeff claimed the permission of Captain Clardy. Deciding to check, the sergeant took him before Clardy and asked if he had given Jeff the permission. Clardy snarled.
"Of course I didn't. This man did the same thing on the march to Wilson's Creek when we were only a few miles from the enemy. I had to punish him."
Enraged, Jeff turned on Clardy, forgetting all caution.
"Sir," he said hotly, "you gave me the permission yourself right here only 5 minutes ago, and you know it."
Shocked by Jeff's effrontery, the sergeant fell back a pace, confusion in his face. He looked uncertainly from one to the other. Clardy sprang to his feet, his face livid with anger.
"Arrest that man," he howled. "You hear me? Take him to the guardhouse. I'm tired of his eternal impertinence. This time, I'm going to teach him a lesson he'll never forget."
Jeff spent one day in the guardhouse, a guarded tent. For 2 weeks, he was assigned to the most disagreeable tasks the captain could contrive, marching about the camp carrying a knapsack filled with rocks, digging stumps, burying dead horses, digging latrines.
Finally, he was switched to a shovel crew that was busily constructing breastworks around the southern approaches of the camp. It was hard work. The ground, rocky and frozen, had to be broken first with a pick. The more Jeff labored, the more his hate for Clardy grew. One day, he passed a husky, brown-faced young workman carrying a big stone. When the workman saw Jeff, he looked so astonished he almost dropped his boulder.
Jeff!
It was David Gardner. Overjoyed, David threw down his stone, ran to Jeff's side, and began to pound him on the back. Then he saw the shovel in Jeff's hands and the dark look on Jeff's face.
"Gosh almighty, Jeff," he stammered. "What are you doing on the ditch crew? Did you desert too?"
That night, Jeff lay quietly on his cold pallet, trying to think. All around him, he could hear the snores of the other prisoners and smell the stench of their unwashed bodies. Slowly, his mind began to go back over the last few weeks. They had been difficult weeks for him, thanks to Clardy's tyranny. Turning on his side, he shut his eyes and clenched his teeth. Although he still hadn't lost his desire to fight in battle, he was torn with loathing for all the cruelty and tyranny that accompanied war. Sleep didn't come to him until nearly midnight. Next morning, after he had awakened and had breakfast, he felt better and began again to dream his old dream, looking forward to the day when he would get off the trench-digging detail and back onto the battle line, where he could settle his old score with the rebel Missourians. With the coming of spring, Jeff knew there would be more fighting. He was right. In May, 1862, 2 months after he won his emancipation from the road crew, he was transferred to Fort Scott, Kansas, and became a part of a federal invasion force of 6,000 men under Colonel William Weir. Weir was a soldierly-looking fellow who had commanded a band of Jayhawkers in territorial days and had been a lawyer at Wyandotte, Kansas. Leaving Fort Scott in June, Weir's army moved down the old military road into the Cherokee Indian Nation. Its mission was to restore to their homes the loyal refugee Indian families who had fled into southern Kansas early in the war. Also, it was to form a protective cover for Kansas and southwest Missouri, operating against small enemy forces in the vicinity of Tahlequah and Fort Gibson. Jeff could hardly wait to start. Nearly 13 months in the army, and he still hadn't fired a shot in combat. Chapter 10. Foraging in the Cherokee Country. The expedition started in early June, crossing the Kansas state line below Baxter Springs and moving down the Grand River into the Cherokee Indian Nation. Pickets were posted every night, for now they were in enemy country, and small parties of rebel Indians prowled all around them. It had been a dry spring, and they were plagued by lack of water every mile of the march. The only running water was in Grand River itself. However, it didn't cross their route often, so they had to rely on the stagnant pools in the bottoms of the dried-up creeks, where small herds of brown Indian cattle stood in the muddy sinkholes, switching their tails and shaking their heads to protect their legs from the large, green-headed flies that attacked them constantly. When Jeff saw the army cooks drive the cattle out of the creeks and scoop up the greenish ooze with their big government buckets and camp kettles, he lost all his thirst and resolved not to take another drink until autumn. However, the cooks kept boiling the muddy liquid and skimming it through clean white dish towels until finally it was usable. He was surprised what good coffee it made. And coffee was all he drank until they veered alongside the river every 3 or 4 days and refilled their canteens. With them were 2 regiments of newly organized Union Indian Home Guards, mostly Creeks and Seminoles, armed with antiquated long-barreled Indian rifles. Jeff had never seen soldiers like them. Their small blue military caps looked ridiculous on their bushy heads. Every night,
They made medicine for the coming battles by singing their weird war songs. The backbone of the expedition consisted of 2 white regiments of Kansas and Wisconsin infantry, 3 of Kansas and Ohio cavalry, and batteries from Kansas and Indiana. Behind the army in creaking wagons rode thousands of Indian refugees, women, children, and aged men, and it seemed to Jeff that every child in the caravan had a pet puppy. Destitute, they were returning to their homes after being driven out by the rebels in the early days of the war. Jeff walked. Although the Rocky Miles stretched endlessly and his feet hurt, he was glad to be back with the infantry. Anything was better than the road gang. As they kept trudging southwestward along the old military road, the weather became unseasonably warm. Although it was spring, no rain had fallen, and the grass was dry enough to burn. The winds blew so hot and searing that the birds stopped singing. Tempers began to grow short, and the men to grumble.
"Nothing here but rocks and dead grass," one protested. "This is Stand Waity's home stomping grounds," another sulked. "I didn't jine up just to fight Injuns. I thought we was going to fight the rebels."
Jeff had heard of Stand Waity, a warlike Cherokee of mixed blood who owned slaves and commanded a small, hard-riding rebel cavalry unit that had begun to raid boldly and sharply the comfortable homes, fields, and livestock of the Union Indian sympathizers who had not yet left the country. Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws, Seminoles, and Creeks, most of them were now fighting actively with the South. He had also heard that some of the rebel Indian troops at Pea Ridge, armed with nothing better than bow and arrow and tomahawk, had scalped dead Union soldiers on the field.
Pea Ridge.
Jeff felt his face and neck redden angrily, even in the stifling heat. Clardy had kept him so long on the road crew at Rolla that he had missed the Battle of Pea Ridge in northwestern Arkansas. His company had fought in it, and it had been the first federal victory of the war in the far west. Herds of brown Indian cattle grazed on the Cherokee prairies, which stretched for miles. Only an occasional clump of blackjack or post oak interrupted the long, grassy flatness. One morning, the brassy sky became overcast, and Jeff looked expectantly for rain.
"Rain, no come," an Indian boy told him.
Impatient with the standard military attire, the Indian boy had thrown away his cap and coat, cut off his blue army pants below the knee, and was marching barefoot with the Union Indian home guards. An ear of corn, half its yellow kernels chewed away, swung from a string at his waist. He was carrying a long-barreled Indian rifle. The furry hilt of a hunting knife showed at his belt. Jeff asked,
"How do you know?" "Before rain come, lots of sign. Sky all red before sunrise, no early dew on ground. Flies thick and stay close to your hands. Fish jump out of water to catch bugs in air. Hickory leaves curl. You can smell the woods better. Hear noises better. Campfire smoke, stay close to ground. None of these signs here now."
Jeff was impressed.
"What's your name?" he asked. "Joe Grayson. I Cherokee. Not many Cherokees in Indian home guards now. By and by, many other Cherokees join up, I think. Most of home guards now Creeks, Seminoles."
Jeff pointed back over his shoulder at the long line of Indian refugees, some walking, others riding in wagons.
"What tribe are they?" "Mostly Creek. Some Seminole, Cherokee too. Ever day, more Cherokees desert rebels, join us."
Jeff motioned toward Joe's bare feet.
"Don't you get tired marching all day barefoot?"
An expression of quiet pride came over Joe's smooth brown face.
"When I get tired, I think of time my mother told me how she walked barefoot, all way behind their wagon from Georgia, when Jackson's soldiers took our Georgia land away from us 20, 25 years ago. If she could walk 800 mile, I walk this 150 easy."
3 days later, they began to pass occasional log cabins, and and see rude brand marks on the flanks of grazing horses, cattle, and hogs.
"Fool bloods," Joe grunted scornfully. "They lazy. All they want to do is live like old-time Indians. They raise little mess corn so family have cornmeal and hominy to eat and swill for hogs, that all. They just want to hunt and eat."
As they penetrated deeper and deeper into the Cherokee country, the farms became bigger and the homes alongside the trail larger. Many of the houses were two-story with tall corner fireplaces and wide porches. The valleys were filled with waving corn. Orchards of peach, apple, plum, and quince grew behind the big homes, and the broad lawns were shaded by gigantic oaks enclosed by plank fences, neatly whitewashed. Jeff had never seen anything like this in Kansas.
"Mixed bloods and intermarried whites," explained Joe proudly. "They run things in the nation. They not like brush Indians. They know how to live."
In mid-afternoon, they passed the blackened ruins of a large home destroyed by fire. The desolation was complete. The fences had been wrecked, and the long cedar lane leading to the front door had been chopped down wantonly. Even the spring house and barns had been burned to the ground. As he saw it, Joe's smooth brown face grew hard.
"That was Clem Van's home. Weighty men burned it down, I think. Van was Union man. All his boys go north to fight. I used to play with his son, John. They had a pet cub bear. We'd wrestle with it."
Joe fought to regain his composure. Finally, he turned to Jeff.
"Rebel Cherokees and Union Cherokees hate each other. Handful of rebel Cherokees, mixed-blood families led by old Major Ridge, signed treaty back in Georgia, giving up all our tribal land there. Waity sign it, too. They had no right do that. Chief John Ross and most of tribe protested, wanted stay in Georgia. But old Andy Jackson, United States president, got his Senate ratify the false treaty. United States government took our Georgia lands and homes away from us. Jackson's soldiers came and made us move to this country. Hundreds of our people died on the long, hard trip. We call that trip Trail of Tears, because they have stopped every few miles and bury somebody. Ever since, Ross Cherokees hate Weighty Cherokees. Lots of assassinations, killings."
Jeff turned incredulously.
"You mean the United States took your homes away from you?"
Joe nodded gloomily. An expression of long-seated resentment came into his dark face.
"My family's home was two-story brick, prettiest in whole Georgia country. It had hand-carved mantelpiece, circular staircase, big pine trees growing all around. My mother loved every brick in it. It had belonged in her family 100 years. She lived in it since she little girl. She got married in it. One day, Jackson soldiers come to take the home and drive mother and family away. Mother stand in yard, look at them. She ask them give her half hour. She take broom, sweep whole house lovingly, burn broom for good luck. Without looking back, she walk out of house and start long walk to this country. She never see her house again."
Sobered by Joe's simple telling of the dramatic event, Jeff marched in silence. He wondered at Joe Grayson's loyalty to the Union after such infamous treatment.
How could the United States have done such a terrible thing?
That night they camped near Cabin Creek. Noah, a shuck cigarette dangling from a corner of his mouth, stooped over the creek bank to scour his knife and fork. He plunged them into the gray soil and wiped them clean on his pants leg. Bill Earl, sprawled indolently on the grass, was rolling himself a cigarette out of a tiny square of newspaper.
"Noah, why are we going to this godforsaken Indian country?" Bill asked.
A bird whistled from a nearby button bush. Noah listened,
trying to identify it.
"To return the Indian refugees following us to their homes, and to impress the Cherokees round Tahlequah and Fort Gibson with our strength, now that we're mobilized. Lots of Cherokees around Tahlequah had to join the rebels against their will. When we show up, some of them might want to change their minds and come back to our side."
He saw that Bill's cigarette was unlit.
"Got a match?" Bill growled.
"Nah, all I got's the habit."
Noah took a quick pull from the burning cigarette in his own mouth. With a long arm, he thrust the hot end of it toward Bill so Bill could ignite his. Bill blew twin puffs of gray smoke out of his nostrils.
"While we're trying to impress them, what's to stop another rebel army from coming up from Texas with twice as many men as us and giving us a good scobbin'?"
"Our commanders probably know there ain't no large rebel force in the Indian country now."
"How do they know?" Jeff asked. He was folding his blanket carefully. The visiting inspector today was Colonel Salomon of the 9th Wisconsin Infantry. He knew how to run an inspection.
"Our scouts and spies probably told him," explained Noah. "Each side has got plenty of spies in the other's army."
Jeff was aghast. Maybe he'd been marching alongside rebel spies in his own outfit that very afternoon. He stammered.
"Corn, Noah. Don't spies ever get caught?"
Noah nodded, placing his knife and fork carefully in his knapsack.
"What happens to him?"
Noah ran his long finger expressively across his throat and went on packing.
"Corn,"
Jeff said again, and decided it must take an awfully brave man to be a spy. A slow rumble of wagon wheels was heard. A wagon, hauled by a yoke of oxen and driven by an old Arkansas farmer, lumbered into view. Halting his wagon in the midst of the soldiers, the farmer moved to the rear, untied one of the sacks, and began selling big, green Henry Clay apples to the soldiers. Jeff hadn't tasted an apple for months. Holding aloft his shin plaster, currency, as all the others were doing, he eagerly joined the mob, clamoring to be waited upon. The whole transaction moved so slowly that Bill Earle climbed jocularly into the front end of the wagon, cut a sack string, and began helping the boys right and left. The farmer hurriedly pushed Bill out. But while he was retying that sack, Noah and John Chadwick lifted out the open sack in the rear and began handing out apples to everybody. At the same time, somebody belted the oxen across the rump with a brush, and they began running, the soldiers hopping alongside, yelling like Indians. Several clambered into the wagon and, despite the farmer's efforts to prevent them, threw all the sacks of apples overboard. Nearly every man in camp got at least one apple, and everybody was laughing. As Jeff bit juicily into his and found it delicious, he could hear the farmer still shouting helplessly,
"Captain! Captain!"
But no captain came. And finally, the old man drove off with an empty wagon. Gradually, Jeff was beginning to learn the Army's careless regard for the private property of civilians, especially food. Petty stealing in camp was dealt with harshly. At Rolla, Jeff had seen the punishment of a Missourian who had stolen $12.50 from a comrade. He was made to stand on a stump with placards marked "Thief" hanging from him, front and back. His head had been shaved, and he had to forfeit all his pay. Moreover, all the other soldiers seemed to think the punishment was deserved. Yet, here was the whole company participating cheerfully in the pilfering of a farmer's harvest of apples and regarding it as a great lark. The weather stayed hot. The trail dusty, the rations short. Some said they were going to Fort Gibson. Others said to Fort Smith. Many times it seemed to Jeff that they were marching for no other reason than just to keep up the motion. Everybody was complaining about the wretched army food. One night when they were still camped on Cabin Creek awaiting the arrival of the supply train from Fort Scott, a bareheaded soldier walked up to their campfire after they had finished eating. He was a moody-looking fellow. His curly, uncombed hair was red as strawberry jam. His piercing blue eyes glinted fretfully, as if he were nursing a grievance against somebody. He glanced hungrily at the pittance of bacon gravy left in the bottom of their camp skillet. Suddenly, he reached one hand back toward his coat pocket, as though to draw a pistol. Jeff ducked behind Noah's broad back. Food was now so scarce that some messes waited until dark, then forcibly took food away from other messes. But instead of a pistol, the stranger's hand came away holding a great piece of cold cornbread. He looked shyly at them.
"I would like to wallop my Dodger in that there gravy if you hain't no objection."
With a dirty forefinger, he pointed to the skillet. They had no objection. After he had walloped, he wasn't long letting them know why he wore that peed look. He told them he was Stuart Mitchell of Council Grove, Kansas, and that he knew all about the weighty outfit, having been their prisoner several months. Mitchell talked with the loquacious annoyance of a man who wants to get something unpleasant off his mind. The war had caught him visiting friends in Texas. Trying to escape to the north, he had been captured by Wadey's men near Boggy Depot. They compelled him to be their body servant. They made him walk 7 miles a day to cut wood for their fires. All he got to eat was a pint of mush and a small piece of beef daily. At night, he slept in a tent. If he stuck his head out, they shot at him. At first, he had got along well with him and thought they were a pretty good lot. They told him about the battles they had won, but when he tried to tell them about the battles the Union had won, they wouldn't let him talk. One of Wadey's rebel corporals threatened to cut off Mitchell's red curls and send them to his rebel sweetheart near Weber's Falls so she'd think he was flirting with a little red-headed gal in Dixie. They threatened to make him sit on a cake of ice to cool his hot northern blood. As Mitchell talked, his blue eyes flashed angrily. Hating the weighty men passionately, he had finally escaped.
"And if'n I ever meet up with them Cherokee devils again, I'll never show 'em any mercy or take a single prisoner," he swore in conclusion.
Fascinated with his first-hand account of the enemy, they invited him to join their mess. It was a gesture of social significance only. The food became so intolerable that a week later they formed a protest committee and called on Milholland. It was dusk. The army had pitched camp where it had stopped along the deeply rutted road. The men were sitting or lying in the gray smoke of the small fires that flickered everywhere, cursing the flies and gnats and wondering how things were going back home. Noah saluted and explained the situation. Bill Earle added,
"Sir, we've been cooking carrots with a squirrel's head, but yesterday we loaned the squirrel's head to Joe Danning's mess, and they cooked it with cabbage and ruined it."
"Sir, we're so hungry we could eat old Wadey off his horse and snap at the stirrups," said Jeff.
Mitchell held up one of the thick army crackers he had been issued.
"Sergeant, if you ain't no objection, sir, these here crackers is so hard I can't break one off in my hands without getting a pry on something."
Milholland squinted thoughtfully at the cracker Mitchell was holding. He knew as well as anybody that the food stank.
"Well," he said with honest practicality, "regulations forbid it, but we can't starve. If you want to do some foraging o' nights, go ahead, but try to take it from families that got plenty. We'll try it a while and see what happens."
Grasping his belt between his forefinger and thumb, he pulled it 6 inches away from his stomach, staring mournfully at the gap caused by his lost weight. Bill Earle grinned gratefully.
"Thank ye, Sergeant. We'll be careful."
At first, the pickings were good. In the daytime, they marched. At night, they raided smokehouses and hen roosts, carrying off chickens, ducks, geese, eggs, milk, and cheese. Once, they found a bee tree. It was a tall ash. Noah chopped it down with an axe. They camped on the spot, building a fire and scooping up the golden honey in dishes and camp kettles. Noah had found several ears of corn in a rebel crib, and Mitchell, who had been a baker at Council Grove, knew what to do. Using the butt of his musket, he pounded the corn into a pulpy meal, adding a little flour, water, and an egg. He spread his black oilcloth cloak on the ground, rolled up his sleeves, and, adding salt to the batter, made a dough so delicious-looking that Jeff's eyes stuck out like marbles as he watched the wet cakes drop from Mitchell's freckled fingers onto the hot pan over the fire. He was sure he had never eaten anything half so good as that hot corn bread and the fresh honey they spread over it. The bountiful Cherokee farms gave up many a hog and a chicken to the small but hungry Union Army of Colonel Weir. The first thing the soldiers did after pitching camp in the evening was to visit the nearby barnyards. Gunshots were heard, then the soldiers returned to camp, carrying game over their shoulders or safely gigged on their bayonets. Although Colonel Weir threatened to punish anybody caught foraging, the pickets usually yawned and looked the other way as the army, tired of the wormy hardtack and the tasteless salt horse, rustled its own provisions. One day the army camped early. Mike Dempsey, the old Irish teamster who had befriended Jeff at Fort Leavenworth, went foraging with Jeff and Bill Earle. Jeff filled his pockets with beets and onions. Bill Earle was straining under the weight of half a sack of last year's sweet potatoes, and Mike had speared a large gray goose with his bayonet. On their way to camp, they passed a deserted log house in the midst of a thicket of black cedars. The waters of a small creek sang sweetly nearby. Jeff halted, looking curiously at the old cabin. Rose and lavender from the dying Cherokee sunset reflected faintly off its broken window panes.
"Let's see what's inside," he proposed.
"Ah, let it go, Jeff," Bill urged. "We already got all we can carry. Nothing there anyhow."
"Might be," said Jeff.
Entering the open door, he explored the dark interior, but found nothing. Just as he was leaving, he heard a plaintive meow, and a large yellow tomcat followed him out into the warm dusk, pausing to arch its back and stretch its toes on the hot ground. Jeff stooped to rub its back, and the fur felt warm to his touch.
"All they left was the house cat," he reported.
He picked up the cat and started back to camp.
"Hey," protested Bill, frowning. "What'd you want to take a cat back with us for?"
Jeff said innocently,
"I don't know. To keep the enemy from getting him, I guess."
Disgust showed plainly on Bill's face.
"Jeez,"
he snorted. Although they waited until dark to enter camp, they had the bad luck almost to collide with a detail of soldiers. A firm voice commanded,
"Halt! Fetch a light, somebody!"
Jeff could feel the sweat crawling down his neck. He knew the penalty for pillaging. 2 days' hard labor digging up stumps. He knew that in his own case, Clardy would cheerfully double it, and, on the grounds that Jeff was an old offender, probably make him stand all night on his tiptoes with his thumbs tied together over an overhanging tree branch. A torch flashed in their faces. They were half-blinded by its sudden glare.
"You men know the regulations against stealing from civilians," a lieutenant scolded sternly.
Jeff blinked and swallowed nervously.
"Sir," he protested helplessly, "we didn't steal it. We just took it."
Hearing the lieutenant's voice, Mike Dempsey glanced keenly at the officer's face.
"It's Lieutenant Sorley, isn't it, sir?" he said,
dropping the goose so he could salute. Its heavy carcass thumped noisily into the weeds at his feet. Surprise creased the lieutenant's whiskered face, vaguely visible in the torchlight.
"Is that you, Dempsey?"
His voice sounded a little more conciliatory. Mike began to chuckle in his hoarse growl.
"It is, sir. Bedad, sir, I can explain everything. I've got a dead goose on the ground here that I had to kill. Me friend's here, and I was going along peaceably, when this goose darted out of the brush and hissed at the American flag. And so, bejabez, I speared him on the spot. What else could I do, sir?"
"Meow,"
purred the cat in Jeff's arms. The lieutenant's head jerked about. Ignoring the vegetables in Jeff's possession, he looked with amusement at the cat riding on his shoulder. Jeff began to feel better. With rough amiability, the officer barked,
"What you got there, mister? A pussycat?"
I know nothing in regulations forbidding the confiscation of a rebel pussycat. Detail dismissed.
Tossing his torch into a nearby fire, he walked off into the gloom.
Whew, panted Bill Earl. That was close.
He turned to Jeff.
That cat saved our necks, and it was my big mouth that tried to talk you out of bringing him.
Picking up their booty, they began walking again, hugging the shadows. Jeff whispered to Mike.
Who was he?
Mike was still chuckling.
Lieutenant Sorley.
His father and I were boys together in County Roscommon, back in West Ireland. Tim Sorley and I used to play Gaelic football together with an old leather ball full of straw. When the lieutenant was a laddie, I held him on me knee many a time.
Bill Earl said,
The good Lord was sure holding all three of us by the hand tonight.
Amen, Jeff said heartily.
Meow,
said the cat, and that seemed to make it unanimous. 3 days later, the command moved on down the military road toward Flat Rock, 12 miles north of Fort Gibson. Again, the northern troops sweltered in the almost tropical heat. No rain had fallen since the expedition had entered the Indian country. The cavalry had constant brushes with small bands of Stanwady's rebel horsemen who raided busily on both flanks. Jeff's outfit had missed the defeat of Clarkson and Wady and the capture of some of their supplies by the Union Creek Home Guards at Locust Grove.
Just my luck, Jeff muttered to Noah Babbitt. I'll never get in a real fight.
Noah was chewing a blade of grass.
That's what I'd call good luck, youngster.
But Jeff didn't see it that way.
All I ever get to fight are these dad-gummed body lice, he complained.
He began to look along the roadside for red pokeberries. Joe Grayson had told him that if you boil up a kettle of pokeberry roots and bathe yourself and wash your clothes in the juice, it would kill all the body lice in creation. They kept walking. The day became hotter and the ground rockier. The straps on the heavy pack chafed Jeff's back. The warm sweat ran down his neck and chest. His rifle barrel felt hot to the touch. Stuart Mitchell drawled laconically,
This country is two rocks to one dirt.
Dixie trotted alongside Jeff, her pink tongue vibrating as she panted. Despite the universal dryness, Jeff had never seen finer cattle country, nor more cattle. He could always look up while marching and see a bunch of beef grazing somewhere. The yellowing blue stem grew stirrup high to a big horse. Occasionally coyotes galloped through it, only the tips of their tails visible. Bill Earl sighed and changed hands on his musket.
Cripes, he panted in his high voice. If this keeps up, it ought to take the frost out of the ground.
They were patrolling the right flank of the main column so they could forage as they marched. They hadn't had anything to eat all day save a prod of ham John Chadwick had found in the ashes of a cold campfire that morning. Noah said the fire had probably been made the day before by Wady's men. Jeff had found a quarter of a pail of sorghum in a smokehouse and filled his canteen with it. Late in the afternoon, they flushed a young beef out of the brush. Herding it to the edge of the woods, they shot it. As it lay kicking, its eyes glazed in death, John thrust his knife into its throat, and a column of blood gushed over the hot grass. After the animal had bled, Milholland flipped the carcass over on its back, carefully turning the head under the shoulder to balance it. He drew his knife and began skinning. Jeff watched with admiration. The sergeant certainly knew what he was doing. Quickly, Milholland straddled the carcass and, working down the belly, slit the hide from chin to tail. Then he slid each leg from the heel to the belly. Grasping the hide with his strong hands, he peeled it off, laying it back so the meat could be cut up on the inside of the hide instead of on the dusty ground. After he had carved off several steaks, Milholland dropped them in Noah's camp skillet. He wiped the knife clean on his pants legs. The ragged men stared with hungry fascination at the fresh meat. John Chadwick blurted,
"Let's stop right here and broil them. We can join the main column later."
Everybody looked at Milholland. The sergeant squinted at the sun and nodded, and Jeff's heart leaped with joy. Bill Earle and Mitchell began breaking off dead tree limbs for a fire. It was Jeff's day to cook. The red meat looked fresh and tender. Jeff's mouth drooled hungrily. He tenderized the steaks by pounding them with the butt of his musket. Noah produced a skin bag filled with white salt, and Jeff salted the meat carefully. Borrowing John's knife, he cut some green switches from a dogwood growing nearby. After the fire burned down, he threaded the steaks on spits over the live coals. Noah wrapped the remainder of the carcass into a slicker. While the steaks were broiling, Jeff found some red pokeberries, dug up the roots with his bayonet, and, borrowing some water from Mitchell's canteen, placed the roots on the fire in a stew kettle to boil. He began pulling off his clothes. So did Mitchell. They were going after those body lice. As Jeff struggled with a knotted shoelace, he could smell the aroma of the broiling veal and hear the steaks sizzle as juice from them dropped into the fire. The smell was maddening. He yanked off his shoes and socks. Mitchell peeled off his drawers and, standing naked by the fire, dropped them into the open kettle. Huge splotches of pink freckles covered his entire body.
"Look," he said, glancing up. "There's riders."
Jeff straightened, shading his eyes with his hand. A dozen men, all mounted, rode into the clearing. They wore boots and slouch hats. All were heavily armed. Jeff shifted his bare feet on the rocky ground, studying them. They are probably from Judson's 6th Kansas Cavalry. A long, piercing yell, shrill as a wildcat's scream, rent the air. A rifle cracked, and Jeff ducked instinctively as a bullet cut through the trees over his head and twigs and leaves fell in a cascade around him. He stared incredulously at the cavalry. Darn fools, couldn't they see the blue pants of the infantrymen?
"Rebels!"
Mitchell shrieked the hated word in mingled alarm and rage. Astonished at the reckless boldness of enemy riders striking so close to Weir's main column, Jeff stood rooted to the spot. Then he heard the swift drumming of hostile hoofbeats, and the Confederates were on them, yelling fiendishly and firing pistols. Cut off from his rifle, which lay against a small hickory where they had skinned the beef, Jeff dived barefooted into a nearby thicket. Dixie was at his heels, her tail between her legs and her ears flattened out. Pistol reports rang out loudly behind him, the noise spanging into the woods, arousing echoes. It seemed the whole rebel army was shooting at him. Letting out his last notch of speed, he ran with all his strength between the trees, scarcely noticing the rocks tearing the soles of his bare feet. It seemed that the concussion of the rebel fire was pushing him along, lending him wings. He felt something wet flowing down his left leg and saw that his pants were sodden with a red stain. Blood! Wildly, he realized he must have been hit, but there wasn't time to stop. The gray-clad riders were yelling fiercely as he doubled and dodged ahead of them. Puffing loudly, he stumbled, fell, and rolled over and over in the rough ground, feeling sharp stabs of pain where the rocks gashed his bare skin. Then he noticed that the shooting and yelling had stopped. Dizzily, he sat up and stared frantically behind him, his breath coming in dry sobs. Apparently, the rebels had fled, fearing pursuit because they were so close to the main Federal column. As quickly as it had happened, it was over. Still panting, Jeff scrambled to his feet and began to search for his wound. He couldn't find it. He wiggled his arms and legs, but felt no pain. He grasped his canteen, which had slipped around in front of him, and noticed that it felt wet and slippery. The last of his precious sorghum was oozing out of a jagged bullet hole. Sheepishly, he realized he hadn't been shot. Instead, his canteen had been hit, and the sorghum had flowed out through the bullet hole and down his leg. His feet were bruised and bloody from the rocks. Brushing off the dirt, he looked cautiously through the trees. The rebels had disappeared into the timber. One by one, Jeff's patrol began to appear. Noah's tall form showed first. He had lost his cap. Blood was dripping from a cut under his right arm. A rebel saber had slashed him.
Where'd they come from? Who were they?
Weighty men.
Mitchell spat out the word venomously, his blue eyes alive with hate. Naked as a jaybird, he emerged from the woods and limped up to the fire. His nude body was reddened from running through the shrubbery. His bare feet were cut and bleeding. Then he saw Noah trying to staunch his wound with his bare hand. Mitchell limped to his haversack hanging on a nearby bush. Reaching into it, he drew out a pint bottle, a quarter full of brown whiskey. Without a word, he handed the bottle to Noah. Noah poured whiskey into the hollow of one hand, flung the raw liquor onto the wound, winced, rubbed it in, then put the bottle to his lips and drained it. John Chadwick crawled out of a nearby hazel thicket. Eyes transfixed, he stared at the fire. He began to curse, pronouncing each syllable slowly and vehemently.
The dirty, low, down so's and so's stole our steaks.
Blinking, Jeff pressed forward to look, his face dull and set.
It was true. Every spit was bare.
Then he brightened.
We still have the carcass, he remembered joyfully. We can still cut us off some more meat.
No, we can't, contradicted John. They stole that, too.
He pointed to where Noah had laid it in the slicker. Gone. The sun was hot. Glumly, Jeff found his hat and put it on. Then he drew on his shoes and stockings. He ignored the boiling kettle of pokeberry roots. The stolen steaks were all he could think about.
They waited until our meat was just about done before they rushed us, John said. Probably been watching us last half hour with a field glass from the woods.
Where's Earl and Milholland?
Noah asked suddenly. Jeff looked at Noah with a premonition of disaster. The rebels had fired a lot of shots. It would be a miracle if all the patrol had escaped. John called loudly several times, but nobody answered. With dread, they scattered and began to search the premises. In the tall grass to his right, Jeff saw an odd depression. The long grass lay flat as though a weight had fallen on it. Staring, his body went rigid. Forcing himself, he walked closer. A blue-clad form sprawled face downward. The legs spread awkwardly. One black shoe was half twisted off the left foot. How crumpled and flattened out and still the body looked. Jeff's breath began to come in gulps. He knew it was a dead body. Whose? A few more faltering steps and he saw the sergeant's chevrons on the sleeve of the dark blue blouse. Milholland. From a small black hole between the sergeant's shoulder blades, fresh blood seeped slowly and darkly, staining the long green grass. Numb with shock, Jeff grasped the body by the belt and turned it over gently. The sergeant still wore his tiny cap with the sloping crown protruding ludicrously over one ear. His eyes, wide open, stared unblinking into the sun. Jeff groped for Milholland's wrist, feeling for his pulse. There was none. His throat tightened and he felt a deep and abiding grief for his friend, and a wild, uncompromising hate for those who had slain him. Dropping to his knees on the ground, he began to sob. Shoes grated on gravel. The others were coming up. Dully Jeff stood so they would see him. He couldn't find his voice. He saw that Bill Earl was with them now. When they saw the sergeant, shock showed in all their faces. They had great respect for this big Kansas farmer who was fast becoming a leader despite his lack of military bearing.
"You murdering Indian thieves!"
Across the stillness of the hot afternoon, Stuart Mitchell's screeching voice lashed like a whip. He began to curse the weighty rider slowly, roundly, and fluently as he buttoned his faded blue shirt over the mat of flaming red hair on his chest. Depressed, Jeff began preparing supper. He had no enthusiasm for cooking. As he rattled the pots and pans, he could hear Bill Earl's and John Chadwick's shovels biting softly into the rocky earth as they dug Milholland's grave a few feet from where he had fallen. Bill and John had hurried back to the main column to borrow the shovels and report the incident, hitchhiking rides with a patrol of Union cavalry they encountered. Noah sat glumly on a log trying to compose a letter to Milholland's wife back in Kansas. Later, a patrol from the 6th Kansas Cavalry, the yellow stripes down their pant legs gleaming in the sunshine, cantered past, raising the dust and sultry clouds as they began the hopeless task of tracking down the rebel raiders. Jeff knew it would be like chasing a heat mirage on the prairie. Ignoring the pain of his bruised feet, he tossed dry wood on the fire. Rice from their rations was all they had to eat. Mechanically, he reached for it. He'd never cooked rice before, but he knew you had to boil it. As he poured water into a gallon stew kettle, he still felt stunned. You marched with a guy for a whole year. Ate with him, bunked with him, learned to like him, learned to obey his orders. And then, suddenly, he was shot in the back, and you buried him and marched away, leaving him lying forever alone in the soil of a hostile land. The water began to bubble. Listlessly, he poured in the rice. They had pooled their rations, but he was afraid there wouldn't be enough. Soon the rice began to boil over and spill down the sides of the kettle. With a big spoon, Jeff tried to salvage the bubbling white overflow, but it was rising and swelling faster than he could ladle it out. Hurriedly, he spread an old saddle blanket near the fire and, with his tin plate, scooped the cooked rice onto it. It made a big, snowy pile. The others plodded up wearily, found their camp plates, and gathered silently around the fire, looking loathingly at the rice. Jeff knew they were thinking about the stolen steaks.
"For them that don't like rice, supper's over," Jeff said.
Ignoring their plates, they ate it off the blanket with their spoons. Chapter 11 Lucy Washburn. Jeff stood on a rocky bluff and gazed through the shimmering distance at Tahlequah, capital of the Cherokee Indian Nation that had joined the Southern Confederacy in the war. Surprise ruled his face. He thought the Cherokees were blanket Indians, like the Potawatomi in Miami near his Kansas home, and that Tahlequah would be a city of teepees scattered over the grassy prairie. Instead, he saw a good-sized town, much bigger than Sugar Mound and almost as big as Leavenworth. It was located among low, green-timbered hills at a picturesque spot near the Illinois River. Many of its town buildings were of brown stone and red brick, and instead of teepees, there were log houses chinked with red clay and chimneys of rock and mud. Spirals of gray smoke twisted lazily into the hot blue sky.
"Now listen, you foot sloggers," bellowed Jim Pike, the new sergeant. "We're coming into town. Captain Greeno says we're to impress him with our soldiery bearing, so smarten up. March good, no profanity, no talking to civilians, no swiping fruit nor vegetables. Close ranks. March!"
Loyal to Milholland and slow to give his allegiance to any new officer, Jeff didn't like Pike, a tall, flint-eyed, thin-shouldered fellow of nearly 40 who spent much of his free time boasting about his experiences in the Mexican War. But Jeff marched good, as the new sergeant ordered. It was 1 week after the death and burial of Milholland. As they plodded along, it seemed to Jeff that the town was slumbering, and nobody in Tahlequah knew there was a war. On the road winding southwest to Fort Gibson, a freighter's wagon, hooped over with gray canvas, crawled through the sand like a June bug. Adjusting his eyes to the distance, Jeff saw what looked like a mail hack crossing the Illinois River at Bean's Ford, the sun reflecting the tiny splashes of water kicked up by the wheels. A solitary Indian boy, humped forward in the saddle, jogged pony